Well, thanks for hanging in with us, folks, for our fourth panel of the day. Fourth but not least, because this is something that covers a matter of an issue of growing significance, became significant during the Bush administration and now is one of growing significance in the Obama administration, that of the status and the manner of public disclosure of White House visitor logs. And I'm going to moderate this panel, so I'm just going to step down to this moderator's position here. Whether it makes me more moderate or not remains to be seen. And tell you first that we have a real sterling panel to talk about this today. I want to introduce first to my right, geographically but not necessarily ideologically, is Christy Callahan, who's a student here at WCL. She's in her fifth semester of being a Dean's Fellow for the Collaboration on Government Secrecy. And she is the one who is our portfolio specialist for the issue of White House visitor logs, amongst policy initiatives and the like. And she is the one who is responsible for this hot off the presses handout that I want to make sure everyone has. What we did is we created a new subsection of the Obama policy section of the CGS website. And you all know how to get to the CGS website. You just type into Google CGS WCL, and that'll pop it right there. If you want to put my surname and the word secrecy, that'll do it just as well. Google favors us with that ready access. And you'll find that now, as of very, very early this morning, we have a subsection that contains just about everything you ever wanted to know on the subject of White House visitor logs from an academic perspective, as well as links to underlying documents, case law, and the like. And Christy worked very hard on that. And she's also going to give you an introduction before we go further down the panel. But when we do, our next speaker after that will be Tom Fitton. Tom is part of an organization, shall I say president of the organization, that I'm guessing hardly anybody has heard about, right? Has anyone heard about Judicial Watch? Right. I think just about everyone has heard about Judicial Watch, certainly in the government transparency area, among others. And Judicial Watch has been, I think it's fair to say, the leader in pressing for access to White House visitor logs. Arguably, in the past, the leader had been another public interest group by the name of CRU, Citizens for Responsiveness and Effectiveness in Washington. But I think it's fair to say Judicial Watch has eclipsed CRU without any question. And Tom has been with Judicial Watch for a good long time, president for a number of years now, and has testified before Congress on this very issue at least twice that I can think of, because we have to include the reference that was made to it in March of last year, as well as on May 3rd before the House Commerce Committee, I believe it was. And then to Tom's right, if that's ideologically possible, is Fred Schulte.
Unlikely.
I don't have to worry about saying such a thing, because Tom will not only accept, he'll go a little bit further. That's right, further to the right. It's Fred Schulte, and Fred is with a public interest organization by the name of, the initials are CPI, which is not Consumer Price Index. It's the Center for Public Integrity. And Chuck Lewis, who bears a connection to American University, main campus type fellow, is one who's founded that organization, I believe. And Fred not only works there as an investigative reporter, but he's someone who has investigative reporting, I think it's fair to say, in his blood. He's a four-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, and he has won awards for probing into government malfeasance, misfeasance, nonfeasance, probably even a fourth type of feasance, if we could think of it. And he's been with the Baltimore Sun and another publication. He's received the George Polk Award, which is no small accomplishment, because I think that's something that the National Security Archive, you don't have to pay them off very much to get one of those, but it means an awful lot. And he has written on this subject, so we're very pleased to have him here. And next to him is someone who's known to many of you, I think, not only because he's been a speaker for CGS in the past. Mike Isikoff was very gracious to be our luncheon speaker a couple of years ago. But he has also followed a career path first from the Washington Post, then to Newsweek, and then as a consultant to MSNBC. You might have seen Mike appearing a good many times on the Rachel Maddow Show, but he's now, let me get the exact title, because Mike deserves to have the exact title used, National Investigative Correspondent for NBC News, a position he's held, a job he's been doing since July of 2010. And Mike is someone who cares an awful lot about the Freedom of Information Act, so we benefit from having him here. So with that introduction to our introduction, let me turn you over to Christy, whose role here is today is just sort of set the stage with some background about the White House visitor log issue, because although it's one that's alluded to in this type of program, we've mentioned it a little bit here, a little bit there, in past programs over the years, we've never devoted an entire panel to it. So our goal here, our aim, is to cover it comprehensively and to address conclusively, as we can, any question you might have about that subject. So with that, pressure's on, Christy. Give us the background, please.
All right. I'm excited to be here today, especially with the panelists I'm sitting alongside. So let me give you a jumping off point about the visitor logs. So before 2006, the White House visitor logs, whether the database was called JARS or WAVES or some other name, were considered records that were subject to the FOIA. The White House visitor logs were considered subject to the FOIA because they were Secret Service records. I don't know if any of you have ever had to visit the White House, but I'm sure you had to give some of your personal information, and that's the type of information we're talking about here. So in 2006 marks a dramatic change. Specifically, in the fall of 2006, not long before the midterm elections that year, there was a lot of controversy around lobbyists like Jack Abramoff. And so the Washington Post and other media outlets wanted to use the FOIA to look at lobbyist activity. So it was right around this time that the Bush administration abruptly decided that the White House visitor logs were not subject to the FOIA on the basis that they weren't really agency records and therefore not subject to the Secret Service control, but rather they were subject to the Presidential Records Act. So in response to this sudden recategorization of the visitor log records, the Washington Post filed a lawsuit. And at that point, the judge issued a scheduling order and made it clear that he was most likely going to rule on the issue before the midterm elections. And so just at that point, ended up being the case that the Bush administration and the Justice Department appealed the ruling and were granted an emergency stay from the Court of Appeals. And so that ended up making the timetable for the case kick back to after the elections. And because of that, the Washington Post lost interest in the case. So, but that's not the end of the story there.
I believe that's one reason why Mike left the Washington Post, because it was prone to lose interest in cases under circumstances. I remember Mike explaining that at the time. So that just ties in very nicely to what you're saying, Christy. You can't count on the Washington Post to really follow through on FOIA.
Well, I didn't research that part, so I can't speak on that level. But so that's not the end of the story. Additional suits were filed, and in fact, some courts have even found that these logs are actually agency records and not subject to the presidential, like the privileges and rights of the Presidential Records Act. But the problem is that the Bush administration never changed their position. And now we're brought to 2009, when President Obama took office. And as you heard during the luncheon address, that he made a lot of promises about transparency. And so many thought that this, of course, would mean reversal of the Bush administration's position on the White House visitor logs. But many people were surprised. And the President Obama, he announced that there's a new voluntary disclosure policy for the visitor logs, which is what brought me, interested in this subject. For the first time ever, the administration made these disclosures automatic, which was a major step forward. But it was also voluntary, and it was still based on the Bush administration's position that this is not an agency record, and so it's not subject to the FOIA. And therefore, you don't have, the public does not have access rights like they do for other FOIA requests. So by creating this automatic voluntary system in which the administration also reserved the right to withhold information to some unknown extent, and no one knows just when and where such information is being withheld. And I actually find this position, it reminds me of a story when I was a nanny for a child, for this family in New York, and the child didn't know what a real cookie was because the child was only three and the mother had only given them things that were very healthy and would call them cookies. And for me, this policy reminds me of that we don't even know, if there is a real cookie out there because it's not announced by the administration. I'll move on. The Judicial Watch responded to the Obama administration, and they requested information through the FOIA. And the Secret Service denied the request on the threshold jurisdictional grounds, and Judicial Watch filed suit, which I'm sure we'll talk more about in a second. In August of this past year, Judge Beryl Howe found in favor of the Judicial Watch. In other words, she found that the White House visitor logs are subject to the FOIA, and in which case the next step is to determine what might properly be withheld on personal privacy or national security grounds, or perhaps even on exceptional deliberative process grounds. So the story of the treatment of the White House visitor logs is not finished. So the government appealed the case with Judicial Watch, and it looks like the case will now finally lead to a dispositive ruling on the issue, and conceivably maybe we'll go up to the Supreme Court. We don't know. So that's it.
Thanks for that setup, Christine. And now the story continues with the interest and the litigation activity of Judicial Watch.
Okay, well, now let me tell you the real story. Now that was a nice recitation of some of the key historical points along the way. I should warn you, I'm not a lawyer, so some of the legal niceties I may not be as erudite on, but I can tell you some interesting behind-the-scenes stories about this process that was unusual even for Judicial Watch's history, which is, some of you know, quite unusual and active, and we got into all sorts of interesting things in litigation. Back during the Clinton years, in investigating the handling of FBI files by the Clinton White House of Republicans that they shouldn't have had, in the course of discovery, we received, in response to a document request, White House visitor logs. So we were able to see up close what they looked like and the type of information that they disclosed. And we understood it was limited, but you could find out when people showed up, generally what room they were going to, who signed them in, when they entered, when they left. Subsequently, during the Bush administration, we were obviously known as an anti-Clinton group because we dared to sue the Clinton administration over corruption issues, and then we confused people by suing the Bush administration over corruption and transparency issues. And as Kristen notes, folks were interested in the visits, for instance, of Jack Abramoff to the White House, a since then convicted felon. We asked for the visitor logs, and the Bush administration fought us a bit. But at the time, they didn't really dispute much that they were subject to the Freedom of Information Act. The disputes we had with the Bush administration at the time were what information that they were giving us in response to the request, as opposed to the a fight over whether or not they were subject to FOIA. And contemporaneously, as we heard, there were other lawsuits by media organizations. But most interestingly, though, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, which was founded specifically as a liberal counterweight to Judicial Watch's activities, had their own Freedom of Information Act requests, and obviously were incentivized to pursue them even more aggressively when we were able to obtain the Abramoff visitor logs related to conservative visits to the White House. There were all these conservative activists. They were interested in finding out about what they were doing at the White House, who they were visiting, and how often they were visiting. And the Bush administration had lost and gotten a little bit of a bloody nose over the Abramoff visitor logs, even though arguably they didn't disclose all that much in the context of the greater scandal. But nevertheless, they didn't like the blowback and the media blowback from it. And to me, the reason they shut it down is because all these other groups started asking for it, and they didn't want the deluge to begin. So they concocted this memorandum of understanding with the Secret Service, where they would go through the motions of pretending to transfer documents from the Secret Service to the custody of the White House, where they would be subject to the Presidential Records Act, which, if at all, would have made them available perhaps as later as 12 years after the administration ended. Crewe continued pursuing these the litigation over whether or not they were subject to FOIA themselves. And the Obama administration came in, continued the Bush administration's rather radical legal position that records that had been found by multiple courts to have been subject to FOIA were magically not subject to FOIA because they took them out of the offices of the Secret Service and brought them to the White House. The most transparent administration in history bought into that. And appointed to the White House as ethics czar was Norm Eisen. Now, Mr. Eisen, who's now ambassador, I think, to the Czech Republic, served as ethics czar, and his chief role seemed as ethics czar was to issue ethics waivers, which is an interesting Washington creation where you get actual waivers from ethics. But Eisen was in charge of dealing with this visitor log issue, and he, I think, negotiated a solution with the crew, a settlement, that resulted in the voluntary disclosure that we've heard about. But the administration continued to maintain the legal position that these records were not subject to disclosure as law, under law. So the position of the administration was, well, we're going to release records after September 2009. Anything prior to that, you can ask for individually, but we're not going to do a mass release. And those records after 2009, we're going to release those records we want to release, and those records we don't want to release for the various reasons we don't want to release them, we're not going to release them. And if you have a question about it or concerns or question about the quality of the records or whether they accurately reflect the underlying Secret Service activity, you're out of luck. You can't go to court. So this lawlessness is something that we would not abide by, and we issued a press release warning what we were going to do, which was to sue, in the fall of 2009. And we got a call from the White House, which is unusual. I don't think we ever gotten a call from the White House directly about an issue like that. And they were told us our press release was wrong, and they wanted us to come into a meeting with high level White House officials. And to me, a call like that is an act of intimidation. However, and maybe it wasn't intended otherwise. But you don't get an invitation from the White House you refuse in this day and age. And as a public policy organization interested in government transparency, you can bet we were going to go down to the White House and see what they wanted us to do, or what we did was wrong. So we show up, we go to the old executive office building, and Norm Eisen is running the meeting. We met in the Secretary of War room, which had been recently renovated. Very nice room. And Eisen said, well, you know, we are inviting you in. Eisen, the founder of Crewe, who negotiated the settlement which protected the Obama administration's legal position that these records are not subject to FOIA, interestingly was involved in this meeting, which is peculiar given his role as ethics czar. Nevertheless, we had the meeting, and he said, well, you know, we heard that you might be friendly to our argument that there were national security concerns about releasing these records, meaning they would have to walk back the cat on prior records, because they didn't—they weren't sure if some of the visitors were there for national security meetings, and they couldn't figure it out. And as you all know, under Freedom of Information Act, you can assert exemptions for national security and other reasons that could have maybe allowed them to get away with not disclosing certain information to us. And we suggested that was the way to pursue it. And we were told in no uncertain terms by Mr. Eisen that it would be good if we said nice things about Obama administration transparency and because they would say nice things about Judicial Watch. You know, and you know, I've been around Judicial Watch in Washington long enough to know, you know, that's sort of outrageous pressure. It's really outrageous pressure. And you know, I pushed Eisen on ethics and the lobbying rules. You know, I thought some of the lobbying rules were silly, but by then they were already violating their own lobbying prohibition policies. They're already issuing all these ethics waivers. And I said, you know, you guys are the ones who talked about transparency, going after the lobbyist culture here in Washington and ethics. You know, some of the policies are good, some of them are bad, but these were your promises, and we're going to hold you to account to them. And so we left without an agreement, and they continued to refuse to release us the records under the Freedom of Information Act, so we sued. And, you know, just to be clear, this was a policy, an innovative legal strategy by the Bush administration to protect itself from political fallout by what we were told was the most non-transparent administration in recent history, and it was a key transparency decision by the Obama White House. You know, and as we'll hear from our next guest, the records they have released are unreliable. And there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of other records that we don't have access to. So it really is a big lie on transparency. The good news is, though, because of the voluntary disclosure, we now know what the cookies taste like and what we can expect when the law finally is applied. But the law is not being applied here. And after a few years, the government finally lost. The Obama administration finally lost. The court who made the ruling was appointed by President Obama. And she found these records are subject to the Secret Service. And all the Obama White House about concerns about national security, the court cited the logic that we cited to Eisen several years before. You know, FOIA allows you to withhold things like that if you have a basis to withhold them. You know, there are all sorts of exemptions you can bring to bear, but you have to bring them to bear under the law. And the administration was ordered to go back to the drawing board and come up with a plan to release these records and assert exemptions. And rather than do that, they stalled for months and months and waited to the last possible minute. Now, admittedly, most lawyers do this anyway in terms of you know, waiting till the time to appeal runs before they actually have to do anything substantive. But they appealed it, and it's now before the circuit here in the District of Columbia. But what I like about the White House visitor logs, it really is an important window into what is a major weakness, and although seen as a strength by the Obama administration, which is transparency and ethics. And the gamesmanship with transparency in the visitor logs, frankly, goes to the president's campaign commercial yesterday. We don't support or endorse candidates, but I noted that he talked about his ethics reforms and his commitment to ethics in his first official campaign commercial. Well, you know, this is a White House that, in order to avoid disclosure under their voluntary proceedings, we've learned from the New York Times, was telling people to go meet with them over in Caribou Coffee so that those visits would not be disclosed under this disclosure policy. That they were setting up meetings across the street in a White House administration building that is arguably not subject to White House visitor logs activity or disclosure under this voluntary policy, where Blair House and the White House Conference Center there, they were meeting across the street there to avoid their historic commitment to transparency. And in my view, that activity just kind of shows you the disingenuousness of the transparency policies of this administration. And it's a real transparency crisis in many ways, because of the effort to avoid disclosure here and the radical stake and the radical take that they've taken in court on White House transparency. This is a major issue. It will not only affect prior White Houses, potentially given the involvement and the intersection of the Presidential Records Act, because it protects President Bush's records, technically speaking, as well, where if their position is upheld, we won't know who visited the Bush White House for a decade. And obviously it will protect any successor. So this is a question of historic significance of White House transparency. And when it comes right down to it, this president doesn't want you to know who visits him under law. Or maybe he doesn't want you to know until 12 years from now, in the least, to be fair to him. So that's our take on it. We won. They lost. This is a last chance, desperate gambit to avoid disclosure before the election, we believe this appellate effort is. But they will, effectively avoid disclosure before the election of all White House visitors or the ones that are subject to disclosure under FOIA. But this is the action of the most transparent administration in history. And the administrative gamesmanship is something we did not see with the Bush administration. At least they told you up front what they were doing and why they were doing it. And the legal positions they're taking, not only in this case but in other cases we can get into maybe if we have more time, are at least equal to, or if not worse than, the obstructionist pro-secrecy positions the Bush administration took. Positions we sued the Bush administration all the way up to the Supreme Court on. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that inside perspective, Tom, that only Judicial Watch, as the longstanding principal public interest group and principal litigator, can provide. Fred, you're from where you sit, or your perch, I guess, as a journalist. You're sort of the archetypical consumer of this type of information. Journalists rely on the FOIA to the extent they can and use information disclosed under the FOIA, but this is just the type of information that someone such as yourself would be interested in seeing, and I know you've written about the story, so...
Right. Well, I do a lot of stories that involve databases, and you know, these White House logs are just another database.
Fred, can you check to see if your light is on there?
There you go. I was saying I do a lot of database investigative reporting, and this is just another database. And so they asked me to take a look at it. And the first thing I did was look for the name of somebody I knew who was at the White House. That turned out to be Bob Dylan, who I'd seen on TV singing a song from the White House. And I look in the visitors' logs, no Bob Dylan. You know, so,
Not Robert Zimmerman?
No. His actual
name?
Robert Zimmerman either.
Just
no.
checking.
Oh,
okay.
No. And so, you know, you wonder, well, if Bob Dylan isn't there, maybe somebody else isn't there. And so I started looking at the thing. Well, one of the first things in loading that database is that you look at it is that it's got two-thirds of the names in there are people that came through on a tour. And so when you put that out, you're making the haystack 10 times as big as a reporter wants it to be by adding all these people that came in on a tour. So the first thing that I did is screen them out. And when you screen them out, the list goes down by two-thirds, and it's a more manageable thing to look at. However, you start to look at, I think Tom mentioned, the various fields they have. Well, there's a great field that's called event description, which is what were you doing there? And guess what? It's blank for 200,000 entries. So that was a little bit of a problem in trying to figure out why people are at the White House, what they're doing there, and the field is blank. The other thing that they have two different fields for one person that brought you in and then one person that you were seeing that you actually had an appointment with. It's the same in thousands of entries. And so I started looking at, well, who were those people? And then you'd look them up and you'd see that there's some junior aide that, you know, they have the White House salary list, that's also online. You could see that they're making $30,000 a year, but a Wall Street billionaire is coming to visit them. And so this also, you know, presented a big problem. When you looked at someone like the Rahm Emanuel, who was then the chief of staff, he had very few meetings relative to some of these junior staffers who had, in some cases, you know, when you added them all up, there were thousands of them. And so this really muddled the picture when you're trying to see what actually is going on in these logs. The other thing is that, and we were looking for another person. We're not obsessed with celebrities or anything, but we were looking for, there was an actor named Ryan Gosling who had been at the White House. He's in the White House log. So I called his agent, and his agent said he didn't go. I said, well, he's in there. And he said, well, he didn't go. So all these kinds of questions started a long succession back and forth of emails between us and the White House, and it turns out that there's a time of arrival field, and if it's blank, they may not have shown up. So So they may have been cleared to the White House, but they may not have actually come there. But they may have. The Secret Service is only interested in certain things, and it doesn't care about that. So then you're not exactly sure whether the person who's listed is in the logs was actually there or not. And there are 200,000 of those in the logs. So, again, that...
Fred, maybe with your mentioning the volume, I can clarify one thing. For those of you who are not familiar with the policy, it's one of the handouts. But what the White House started doing as of the end of 2009, not covering the first 8 months of the administration, but as of the end of 2009, is just automatically, regularly making a release in data form every 3 months, a quarterly automatic disclosure. So what Fred is describing is these data sets the White House every 4 months will release, and you get what you get.
You get what you
get. And one of the problems is, even putting aside something, whether something is recorded or not, you never know what has been withheld. If it were under the FOIA, it would be as exempt, and you'd be able to see it blacked out. But you don't know what has been withheld or what wasn't written down or typed down to begin with. There's no distinction made because there's no law that requires otherwise.
Right. Well, and then also when you looked and you sorted the data to look for the dates of arrival and saw, which was part of the case that Tom mentioned, that there's virtually nothing there. There's only a few hundred entries for the first 8.5 months of the administration. And, you know, considering that the reporters want to look at things like the discussions leading up to the health reform law, this flurry of activity that the new administration was involved in, yet there's nothing. Not nothing, but you can specifically request by the names of individuals, and within a period of time they may go ahead and add them too. So as more of these come out, and it's up to over a million, it's way over a million now. The data is getting to be really quite massive. You never know what's something.
Fred. Huh? The number that the White House claims is 1.9.
1.9. Okay, it's getting so big you can't even put it into a lot of standard databases. So that's another problem if you're trying to do this kind of analysis. The thing is so big you need to be, you need a lot of skill, data skill, just to do it. We also came across something that says records related to a small group of particularly sensitive meetings are not in there. And we never really got an explanation as to what a sensitive meeting was, except... they said something about it won't be disclosed until it's no longer sensitive. And then the example they gave was a Supreme Court nominee coming to the White House. They're not going to release that until after that person becomes a Supreme Court justice. Then they might release it, but you're not exactly sure when or ever they're going to release it. And then the other big thing to us, because at the Center for Public Integrity, we'd written about the overnight stays during the Clinton administration in the Lincoln bedroom. And it caused quite a stir because big donors were being allowed to come in and stay overnight in the Lincoln bedroom. Well, one of the pieces of this policy is that there are no records like that or guests of the family that are included in these logs. So you simply cannot find out who stayed overnight or anybody that was considered to be a friend of the family is exempt from this policy. So we came to the conclusion that there's really a lot of holes here. But that's not to say that there isn't some valuable information in there, but mostly what we've been using it for is looking at campaign donors, bundlers, in this case the people that were the largest campaign donors, the people that go out and get wads of cash like from 50 to 500,000 and donate to the campaign. And one of the things that we've been looking at is that what kind of perks did they receive, how many visits to the White House have they made, what kinds of meetings have they gone to. And the logs, we were able to use the logs for that, to look at some of that. But generally speaking, there's so many holes in them that more often when you get down to the really starting to look at who was at a certain meeting, you can do that in theory. You can look, you can see there were 19 people. There was a meeting. This was the person that held the meeting. And then you try to find the 19 people in there, and you can find six. And this happens all the time. So it's extremely frustrating. And then you get the explanation, well, those could have been people with security clearances. Then there's any number of explanations what they could have been. But the bottom line is you can't figure out who was at a specific meeting, what they were doing there. And that's the kind of thing that the press is trying to use these logs for. So that's been a little bit frustrating.
I'm curious, Fred, before we move on to Mike Isikoff, in your dealings with the White House, you say you've gone back and forth with emails trying to figure out at first at least what was what and what it meant. Have you had any discussion with them or communication about, well, can we file a FOIA request and do it the old-fashioned way? In other words, under the disclosure policy, is that possible?
Only if you ask for certain individuals, right, that are not in there now, they will, at 3 months later, they'll put them in there, they say. So you're waiting, you have to wait for 3 months. If you want to know for a story that you're writing for tomorrow's newspaper, you know, about somebody, they'll tell you, well, maybe you'll get it in 3 months.
When you say put that in there.
Put that in the dump that they do, as you said, it's getting bigger.
Add that to the quarterly automatic release.
In an automatic release.
Whereas otherwise it would not have been automatically in that release?
It would only have been released if someone requested it, and that's part of the legal case.
Do they explain, if it were not otherwise in that release, but for your contact with them, what the basis for not releasing that would be?
It's one of these, you know, one of these various exemptions.
But you wouldn't know.
You wouldn't know.
Not just that it's riddled with holes, which is one of your.
It's there and plenty of catch-22s.
You don't know where the holes are, do you?
No, you don't know where the holes are.
Okay. The White House says, as part of its policy, that it will entertain FOIA-like requests, but only to the extent that it regards them as reasonable. That reasonableness standard is one that doesn't apply to FOIA requests under the law. Anyone who works for an agency and has responded to requests that seem way beyond reasonable know that the law does not establish a threshold sieve of reasonableness, yet that is what's built into the standard as well. Mike, you've been around for a long time, and you're not shy about calling something for what it is. How does this all strike you?
Fascinated, you know, was Bob Dylan there for a particularly sensitive meeting?
Well, he's saying the times are changing.
I guess
the answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. I think.
Was there ever an explanation for why Bob Dylan didn't show up?
There was no explanation, and you know, we could only speculate. I don't know. It's possibly stayed overnight. Well, if he's an overnight guest, then it's not disclosed.
I intend to demand an explanation for this.
Let us know how that works out.
Follow
please.
Up on it. I think that everybody's laid out, I think, the really key issues here on this. And just taking a step back, given the overall thrust of what this whole symposium is about, transparency and looking at it. I mean, the White House visitor logs are a piece of it, and it has some pros and cons, which I'll discuss in terms of my own reporting. But and maybe your earlier panels have already dealt with the mega questions here. But when this is an administration that has pushed the envelope in terms of executive power, relying on secret Justice Department memos relating to its foreign policy, its drone strikes, the Libya incursion, and most striking of all, the determination that it has the power to unilaterally determine American citizens who could be assassinated by the American government, and we've never seen the legal memos upon which they're relying. That strikes me as much bigger than any of the issues we're talking about here and any of the issues they'd like to talk about when they talk about transparency. Yes, they have made modest reforms that I think have made some difference around the margins, but on the big questions, the things that most scholars and journalists and the public would care about, it's hard to see how they've staked out any ground that's different than their predecessors, who, and in particular their immediate predecessor, who they denounced for its secrecy. And, you know, as somebody who spent a lot of time covering national security issues during Bush administration and remember the battles over the secret memos that permitted torture and warrantless surveillance and waterboarding and all the big mega issues that people were talking about just, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. It's really striking to me how similar the Obama administration positions are when it comes to their own national security decisions. Yes, they released the Bush administration memos, Office of Legal Counsel memos on waterboarding and extraordinary rendition and enhanced interrogation techniques, but they haven't released their own memos relating to what they're doing. And so I think any discussion of transparency about the Obama administration record on transparency has to sort of start out with those mega questions. Now, that said, the White House visitor logs. I've used them. I used them for one story, which I did find them modestly helpful. In fact, I was able to rely on them for the basis for a story. It took a hell of a lot of work to navigate these records that they have and trying to find them. I've discovered, as Fred did, that they are not always accurate. In one case, I found I was looking at the Romney healthcare advisors who were called in to the Obama White House to consult with on the Obama administration healthcare proposals. Actually, a story that was not inimical to the political interests of the Obama White House at all. You know, I spent a lot of time trying to understand the records and use them and found some useful material in it, but I also found I would call somebody who was showed up in the visitor logs 8 or 9 times and ask them about the meetings they had at the Obama White House, and in some cases they insisted to me they were never there or had been there for maybe 1 or 2 meetings, and then I'd say, well, you know, you're listed here for 9, 10, 11 meetings, and I said, and I would get answers like, yeah, that was scheduled at one time, but it was canceled, or I never went, or...
So they were at Ryan Gosling's house instead, was that it?
Yeah. I mean, it just was clear that the records, and there was no real way to determine from the visitor logs whether or not the meetings ever really had taken place. In some cases, I discovered they had, or at least the people I spoke to confirmed that they had been at meetings, and then others they said that had been scheduled and had they listed they never were there for. Like Fred, I discovered that you couldn't, it was pretty impossible to discover from the, to figure out from the logs who they were meeting with, because in one case I found somebody who confirmed to me that they were a meeting with the president himself on this, and it was in the Oval Office. And not only was the president there, but there were cabinet members and Rahm Emanuel and Peter Orszag, the OMB director, were there. And then you looked at who was the records, the log showed, let them in, and it was a junior staffer who you'd never guess was letting in the somebody for a meeting with the president. And then also, because the particular issue that I was dealing with was mainly meetings that took place during that first 9-month period, as has been discussed, there was no disclosure at all for that period. It was only, I found out, if you made what the White House determined to be a reasonable request you could get answers. So I had to give them the names of about half a dozen Romney healthcare advisors who I believe may have been at these meetings, and then they ran those names through the database, and I was able to get answers on them, on some of them.
Do you know if you got answers on all of them?
No, of course. There's no way of determining whether you got answers on all of them, and I don't think that the records themselves, because they are so imperfect, could possibly yield the answer. I mean, the one question I would have for Tom and Dan as well is, if instead of this voluntary disclosure database that the White House has made, we went back to FOIA as the response, and we were FOIAing Secret Service logs, given the apparent inaccuracy of those logs themselves, whether we'd be any better off. I mean, if the Secret Service logs are not really a reflection of who's visiting and who they are visiting at the White House, would it make any difference if they had to follow, if they had to respond to FOIA requests, because we'd file them and then get a inaccurate entry in a Secret Service log. So I just throw that out there. My general view is, anytime we can get more information rather than less information, that's a good thing. I'll take it. I'll push for more. But I'm not going to celebrate the method that the White House has adopted to deal with these. But on the other hand, I don't want to completely condemn it either, only because I'm not sure the alternative of the FOIA route would be a whole lot better. But that said, let's leave it up for discussion.
Thank you, Mike. Tom, I certainly want to ask your view on the question that Mike posed, but before that, I'm going to attempt sort of an academic analysis and suggest that there really are two closely connected but distinct issues here, or matters here. The first is the recordation of information that reflects what actually in reality occurs. And then the second is, as to what is recorded, whether it's disclosed, and ancillary to that is, and if it's not disclosed, is it even known to the public that it hasn't been disclosed? And what you've pointed out, Mike, is that the very process of creating the database, at least currently, is one that appears to be inexact, just to use a neutral word, and as a result of the inexactness of what is written down in the old-fashioned way, although it's not written down, it's typed in, we all know that, there's a discrepancy or a gap right there. And then it's a separate question, when you take as a given to what the logs actually have in there, for better or for worse to begin with, as to what would be disclosed and under what circumstances. So there might even be, for journalists, there might be a first threshold issue is of, listen, if you're going to have database disclosures and have a regular system where people rely on that and purportedly use it, can you do a better job of recording the information, neither over-recording nor under-recording? But then the separate question is, okay, and then whatever you do write down, what you do with respect to disclosure. I think the concern you raise, Mike, at least as I see it, is more of the first rather than the latter, whether it's accurately or precisely recorded to begin with.
Right, but just to add, I do want to hear Tom's perspective on this, but as I understand it, the visitor logs are based on the records kept by the Secret Service. And so those are the agency records that groups like Tom would like to be FOIA-able, and if they were, I guess the question I'm posing is, would they be any more? It appears to me like they would be just as inaccurate as the records we're getting from the White House now.
I don't disagree with that, and I don't disagree with your implicit point there, and winning in court, which we've already done, there is no basis in law. Just to remind everyone, right now there's no basis in law to withhold these records. The records are imperfect. The Secret Service says that we maintain these records not to create an historical record for Stoops like Judicial Watch and Mike Isikoff, but to maintain the security of the White House. And the rejoinder to that is, and I think this will highlight the need for reform there, is maybe the Secret Service's security procedures there are weak. Because if you don't know why someone's visiting, you don't know who they're visiting, or the person who's coming down to get them isn't really the person who's responsible for the meeting, I don't know how, as a Secret Service official, you can say that the security is being done the way it needs to be done in the White House where the president is. And so I think that could be a nice, interesting development once, and I think smart people ought to be talking about that, security professionals. And secondly, of course, you know, once the law is resurrected here, reasserted, not only will these records from 2009, the tens of thousands of records that are now withheld, absent guesses for names that may have visited that you may get a hit on, there will be millions of records potentially released from the Bush administration. And let me just make another quick point on transparency, because, Michael, you made the point about these voluntarily the issues of national security disclosures and the secrecy there. You know, one of the biggest decisions and the most troubling by the this administration on transparency was related to Fannie and Freddie. And this was not a decision that the Bush administration had made. This was a decision that was made during the Obama administration. Fannie and Freddie went into conservatorship. And all the records we know were taken whole by the Federal Housing Finance Administration. They admitted they'd taken control and custody control of all the records. And so we had the bright idea of asking, well, you know, we all know the controversies around Fannie and Freddie. They kept all these people employed. They were making all these donations to Republicans and Democrats, proportionally speaking. I think it was, I don't know if it was CPI or Open Secrets. You're not Open Secrets, are you? No, that's the other. President Obama, proportionally speaking, was the highest recipient of Fannie and Freddie political funds. So we said, well, now these are all government records. We know there's a controversy over what they bought when they made those contributions. Let's ask for those records because they're government records. We're spending upwards of $150 billion, at least to date, bolstering Fannie and Freddie with taxpayer money. The Obama administration made the decision that these are not records subject to the Freedom of Information Act. And we fought that in court so far unsuccessfully. And the legal hook they used was that we don't use the records. We don't use the records, which we think was an outrageous twist of what the law was. The question of agency use of records, making them subject to FOIA, was meant to cover, you know, some IRS official, for instance, having Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities on his bookshelf, and that was not an agency record because it wasn't used in the course of his work. But that's the twist that the Obama administration brought to bear. So we're spending $150 billion plus with no limit. We have a potential liability of $5 trillion with the mortgages that those two agencies are guaranteeing, all on the taxpayer. And this administration has said not one record is subject to FOIA. You can get a record from the CIA, but you can't get a record from Fannie and Freddie that is run wholly by this administration and this government. And ironically, who does that protect this time around, this year? Newt Gingrich. Wouldn't it be interesting to get the contracting information between Freddie Mac and Newt Gingrich? Well, under this administration, you won't be able to get it. They might be able to withhold it even under FOIA.
They might reverse their decision around October.
Yeah, but the third point quickly is that you can never trust voluntary disclosures by any administration. National security memos that are released, we know in the enhanced interrogation debate, they selectively released records that had that were more designed for a political impact than for a historical overview that provided you all the information. Same goes with the White House visitor logs. And I don't blame reporters for relying on voluntary releases in their professional judgment to report information about government activities. But if you want the truth, you have to be able to pursue these records pursuant to law and hold them to account pursuant to law. That's the only way to guarantee, or to better guarantee, that you're going to get an accurate portrayal of what went on in terms of the question you're asking for.
Tom, let me take your point about accuracy on the visitor log records and together with what Mike said, and just try to make another distinction. I want to tease out what is a subtle point, I think, but fundamentally under the FOIA, where the FOIA is agreed to apply, the rule or the approach or the philosophy is that federal agencies create and maintain records in order to perform their missions. They don't create records for purposes of public disclosure. Certainly they never did before the FOIA was enacted, and that really is not part, by and large, generally speaking, of their mission now over the last 45 years. But your point might be, Mike, and Tom as well, that if the Secret Service records here are going to be used by the administration, held out as evidence of what takes place, for reliance on that, even if the limitation on what is maintained is what is all that is necessary for the Secret Service to perform its security mission, and that's all it creates it for that way, maybe now it needs to go beyond the needs of its mission and be more comprehensive about what it records in the first place. The holding out of it is what changes the dynamic here and takes them beyond just the mission basis for recordation, record creation, and to something else. And apropos of that, I guess, as to holding out, I wanted to ask you, Tom, just quickly, because we have a limited amount of time. I note that you testified last spring a couple of times before the House, but you talked about the fact that the White House is repeatedly trumpeting this process of automatic disclosure as if it's a plus. Do you see it as on balance a plus versus a minus, or a minus overall? It's a leading question, I realize. But there's even another news article that says White House brags of voluntary visitor log disclosure forced by judicial watch. Well, do you see this as something worth bragging about?
Well, they're going to politically try to highlight and benefit from the, and it is unprecedented, release of information in such a widespread fashion about logs, about visitors to the White House. But, you know, taking the perspective that the law is being undermined by this position that they're voluntary and not lawful disclosures, they're wrong to brag because they're bragging about violating the law. They're bragging about standing against the law. And there may be benefits to people interested in what goes on in the White House to that position, but the position is at odds with the president's and his officials' duties to uphold the rule of law.
Fred and Mike, how do you see the glass? Is it half empty, half full, or is the proportion different? How much of the glass is full and how much of it is empty on this particular subject area?
It's really hard to say.
I
mean, that's the whole thing. And they say, we'll provide you with information about people. Just tell us who you want to know about. Well, you don't know who is there, so how do you know who to ask for? I mean, it is. It's a catch-22, and I think that's the problem with the FOIA approach. But they obviously have given some valuable information. I mean, I think in fairness to the White House, you have to say that I did find a large number of one-on-one meetings with President Obama where it's identified in the log as one person is there and the meeting's in the Oval Office and the person visited is POTUS. And I was looking particularly at the big campaign donors who got one-on-one meetings with the president, and there were quite a few. So obviously that was we considered to be newsworthy information, and in fact they did disclose that. So it's not totally nothing. I mean, there are some really, really good things in there, but it really isn't what they said it was. And that, to me, is part of the crux of this thing. And in fact, it is true that they did. I wouldn't necessarily use the word brag, but if you go back and look at the blog posts that the White House put up, they did at one point say, "We have now released the names of every single person who came into the White House." And it did, in fact, say that. And I have a printout. It may have changed the wording a little bit, but I have a printout of the original. And it did, in fact, say that. And, of course, that simply was not true.
It's not bragging. It's more than bragging.
Yeah, but I do want to say, I mean, Fred's reporting on the campaign bundlers that have been to the White House and the meetings they had was very valuable, excellent reporting, and it was based on the visitor logs. You know, I have to say that as much as, you know, if the glass is just the visitor logs, I would probably say it's at least half full. If the glass is transparency in government, I'd say the water is well less than halfway up there.
About this much? And yeah. Then if you factor in what the expectations were, yeah. Does that take it even, this is a leading question, obviously.
Yeah,
does that make it even less?
I can't be precise on, you know, on the amount of water in the glass.
You know, under FOIA, they have to respond more or less within 20 days. Under this voluntary disclosure policy, they have 90 days to disclose visits. So it seems to me there'd be an intense interest in who's visiting the White House, you know, in the months preceding an election or certain political events.
But the limitations on the FOIA process, as you all know, are great as well. I mean, we can wait.
Right.
You know, I've waited years to get responses to FOIA requests. So
that's because you're so shy.
Getting everything in real time from whoever wants them.
Right.
Because
you're not using Judicial Watch to gain access to them. That's why.
Well,
the law allows you more timely access, especially if you're willing to sue on them and in matters of public importance.
That's the catch.
But that's not available according to the White House. No, there's no law there. There's no law that can help you.
But yeah, I don't think you'll find a reporter in Washington that thinks FOIA is an effective news gathering tool. Especially with the speeded up system that we have here where everybody, you know, you need something really, really fast and FOIA just doesn't cut it.
Yeah. Anybody have any questions? We have just a little bit of time to throw it out to the audience on this side.
I have a question.
Oh, I did not mean to exclude you.
It's all right.
Students get priority here at this school.
So we've joked around about the celebrities like Ryan Gosling and Bob Dylan, and even recently Johnny Depp's name has come up because I guess he was there for Halloween and it wasn't on the logs. And I found that story actually a little bit more interesting because obviously, you know, I like Johnny Depp just like anyone else, but I found it interesting because the reasoning that the White House has given is not been consistent, and I was just wondering if you have found that to be the case with other inquiries you've made.
Wouldn't he fall under the sort of personal guest clause?
Actually, the reason why it's interesting is because they said that Tim Burton and Johnny Depp were there to consult about the Halloween party. It wasn't just personal visitation.
Well, they're personal guests to the family, and that would not be included. Mm-hmm.
Please, yes.
Liz Bergman death that visitors think they were working. My guess is that's the same reason Bob Dylan did. He was there as a tour, so he was working, so he's not a visitor, therefore he doesn't show up at all.
Right, except the problem with that is that quite a few performers are in there, like Stevie Wonder's in there a lot, Smokey Robinson, you know, who also performed, were listed. There's a whole lot of them.
My name's there. I was working. It doesn't tell you who I was visiting with, though, yeah. or what the topic of the meeting was.
And there is another problem with that. I can tell you from my own experience back in my prior life representing the White House in court at the Justice Department, we did have circumstances in which, especially during the Clinton administration, the nature of what was then called the JARS system and the WAVE system was in question. People who work like that, I'm not just talking about a workman or woman who's cleared to do custodial work or to come in and build a shelf or something like that. People who come in and perform, they go through the system. Otherwise, I could bring in a mariachi band and slip my terrorist cousin in there. I guarantee you they clear these people, even if they come in as performers. For security purposes, I mean, I'm going to agree with what Tom said. It's just inconceivable. So I would go back and question that explanation. It doesn't pass the smell test, I don't think.
Right. You do. You can look in the logs, too, and see the various, the Marine Band, you know, like, and they're in there. So everybody that comes in, the musicians, they definitely do check you.
Yeah, this working thing just doesn't wash. Yes, sir.
Do you have time for one more? One
more
question. So this question is more for Tom, or at least going back to the August decision. What's the status on that?
Well, as the district court, Judge Howe, ruled in our favor and said these are records subject to the Freedom of Information Act, and that the White House has concerns about specific disclosures. There are exemptions under FOIA they can try or attempt to assert that we can argue over further in legal proceedings, I presume. But rather than do that, they've appealed that decision, and now, you know, it's going to be several, I mean, it's going to be another year before we probably have a resolution or a ruling out of the appellate court.
The opening briefs have not been filed yet, I don't think so.
I don't think it's ready till at least when the opening briefs do. My lawyer colleagues
are
here.
People in the audience.
Has a briefing schedule even been set? There's been no
briefing schedule
set.
Even though the appeal was filed in October.
So.
Wow, that's slow for the D.C. Circuit.
9 months plus.
Okay.
Which places it past the election.
And so the second or the follow-up question to that would be, do you think it would take a Supreme Court decision on something like that?
I personally, in my layperson's analysis of what I understand the law to be, this is a slam dunk. The court is not going to back the White House up. I mean, my only concern is that, we talk about separation of powers and how the government, the judicial branch is a check on the executive branch. My only caveat is that the stone wall often extends from Pennsylvania Avenue down to the courts on FOIA matters. So, you know, I'm always worried about creative interpretations of FOIA that exempt these types of records. But, you know, my understanding of the law, there have been three different judges that have ruled similarly on this, and I just don't see the court even bothering, assuming that the appellate court rules in our favor.
Well, perhaps next year when we gather for the fourth annual assessment of Obama transparency, which probably would have to be other than on Inauguration Day, because I'm informed not only is it a Sunday, but the parade will be the next day. So we'll have to work out the scheduling. But perhaps when we come back next time, we'll have an answer to that question. And we can have a panel on the other issue that you raised. There'll always be another issue to be discussed. But for this one, I want to thank panel members very much for offering their perspective on transparency in general. I want to thank the audience for your patience and kind attention throughout. And we now have a reception upstairs, just up those steps in the foyer, which we do call the foyer, especially after the third drink. And look forward to seeing everyone back here on March 16th, 8 weeks from today. That will be the 18th program that CGS has had. Thank you, everyone.